I knew very little about this topic January this year. In fact, I knew nothing about this topic January this year, which is the assumption I'm making about most of the audience this morning, not to sort of cast aspersions on any of your revolutionary valour or desire to read books or anything, but simply because the history of these comrades, some of the most inspirational and moving stories that I've read in my time reading a sort of revolutionary histories has actually been completely sort of eliminated from the face of left history for reasons that I'll go through in my talk. So it's been a very moving experience finding out about the struggles of these incredibly brave and self-sacrificing comrades in Vietnam. So I want to start with a quote actually though from a quite different historical period in another part of the world that I think really reflects very well on why this is so important that we actually study the history of Trotskyism in Vietnam in the 1930s and 1940s. And this is from the Theses on the Philosophy of History by Walter Benjamin, who was a German Jewish Marxist philosopher who tragically died fleeing Nazi persecution in 1940. And he wrote these sort of reflections on the failure of the social democratic movement in Germany, what sort of attitudes Marxists should have towards the question of history, how history builds into our movement. And thesis 6 reads, "To articulate the past historically does not mean to recognise it the way it really was," which is Ranke's famous positive historiography. "It means to seize hold of memory as it flashes up in a moment of danger. Historical materialism wishes to retain that image of the past which unexpectedly appears to man, we'd say to humanity, singled out by history at a moment of danger. The danger affects both the content of the tradition and its receivers. The same threat hangs over both, that of becoming a tool of the ruling classes. In every era, the attempt must be made anew to wrest tradition away from a conformism that is about to overpower it. The Messiah comes not only as the Redeemer, he comes as the subduer of Antichrist. Only the historian will have the gift of fanning the spark of hope in the past who is firmly convinced that even the dead will not be safe from the enemy if he wins." And this enemy has not ceased to be victorious. And days later, Benjamin died and the Nazis went on to eliminate, you know, a whole history of our movement physically, the Jewish socialist tradition, the Yiddish tradition. Now, never have these words been more true, I'd say, than the case of Vietnam's heroic revolutionary socialists. Not only were they defeated and physically eliminated, their legacy has been hidden, has been distorted, has been written out for the best part of 60 years now. This talk, just to give you an instance of this, is reconstructed almost entirely from impossible-to-source pamphlets, old articles, obscure polemics and memoirs. You know, the main historical document of any use on Vietnamese Trotskyism that gives you an overview is produced by the Hillelites in the 1980s when they're falling out about the nature of Russia and are fighting one another. It's sort of purely accidental that we find out any of this information. So it's a hidden history we need to rediscover as we make our own in the 21st century. There's three waves of this repression that we can go through the writing out of this memory. The first is Stalinism, for obvious reasons. You don't want to acknowledge there's actually a revolutionary tradition in this country. The second is bourgeois history, you know, the so-called history of the academic departments, again, because the possibility of struggle isn't something that bourgeois historians are too keen on. They're not too keen on it by any means. And thirdly, though, and I think we have to say most shamefully, because these are people that should have known better and hadn't, you know, didn't have the excuse of ignorance, This history was written out by many of the radicalized youth leaders of the 1960s who had illusions in Vietnam and Ho Chi Minh as a socialist society. Figures like Tariq Ali in the United Kingdom, or what is now the Democratic Socialist Perspective in Australia, downplayed or outright denied the struggle and the heroism of the Vietnamese Trotskyists. So this talk has three aims. Good things come in threes, yeah? The first is to give comrades a sense of history. Yeah? The history of the Vietnamese Trotskyism is one of a tiny group of students, and I mean tiny group of students. Yeah? Like there were fewer Vietnamese Trotskyists when this talk starts than there are people in this room at the moment, managing against enormous odds and in the face of truly awesome repression to transform themselves into a fighting force in the working class. So it's an exciting story. Yeah, it's a really exciting story. But secondly, and crucially, I think, in a meeting that's happening in Australia, being addressed from someone from another country in the Pacific, is to shatter the myth that revolutionary socialism is a Western phenomenon, yeah? Stalinists and liberals always assert that Trotskyism has been a movement confined to the fringes of the left. Yeah, this is the standard slur of the Stalinists and their sort of latter-day inheritors. This life serves their own purposes, but we need to rediscover the legacy of our movement here as internationalists, you know, in the Pacific and in Asia. How many of us know, for example, of Yamanashi Aishi, the founder of Japanese Trotskyism, or of the major parties built in Sri Lanka and Bolivia, you know, two of the largest Trotskyist parties in history? Far from being a Western phenomenon, revolutionary Marxism, in other words, Trotskyism, is a current of the world workers' movement. Vietnam has a proud place in our tradition. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, I think we want to show the interconnection of international questions and domestic struggles, of theoretical questions and of practical demonstrations, of, you know, questions of perspective and of questions of action. All through their campaigns, the attitude of the Vietnamese workers' movement to wider world theoretical questions on colonial policies, on world wars, on the place of the democratic and the socialist revolution played a key role, for better or for worse, in domestic affairs. So this talk is another reminder, if it's ever needed, of how our insistence on theoretical clarity isn't a pedantic add-on, but a precondition for success. So, Vietnam. The Vietnam we first meet in this talk is a country ruled as a colony of France, with all the daily humiliation and oppression that involves. Those of you that have read Graham Greene's The Quiet American or seen the not-so-good film that was made of it a couple of years ago, would get a sense of the corruption and disrespect this meant to the Vietnamese. You know, second-class citizens in their own country. I think Green gives a really good sort of sense of how there's just daily degradation is what it means to be Vietnamese. You know, you're the servant in a country that, A, you're doing all the work in, and B, is your own. But, of course, the French presence also meant factories, you know, the development of the Vietnamese working class, industrialisation. The French influence is huge here. You know, it's one of the reasons why the best baguettes in Melbourne are in Richmond and in Footscray, not in the sort of expensive French bakeries that you see around the place. The French divide Vietnam into three regions. There's Tonkin in the north, which is a more peasant-based, less developed area. There's Annam in the middle, which is a French protectorate. And then there's Cochin China in the south, which is an out-and-out colony. They rule it directly. So, in the early 1920s, a young intellectual called Nguyen Ai Quoc, known to the world and for the rest of this talk as Ho Chi Minh, has returned to his home from studies in France and has founded the Indochina Chinese Communist Party. There's a series of splits in their ranks in the 1920s, which don't concern us here, and I won't mention them again. And then there's a virtual insurrection of peasant groups under the leadership of the Communist Party in 1930. Now, this insurrection, very brave insurrection of the peasants against French oppression, is defeated and routed, you know, absolutely routed. I'll give some figures to give a sense of the scale of the oppression. 4,000 were arrested and a further 1,760 executed in the course of the repression. So the origins of Vietnamese Trotskyism don't lie in the Communist Party, you know, unlike in many other countries, but this background's important. It's important for one reason, I think. Because the party had been so badly defeated, so massively smashed in 1930, it didn't represent sort of a mammoth bloc in the Vietnamese workers' movement that sort of blocked the development of revolutionary socialism in a way that these sort of huge communist parties around the world did in many other countries. You know, somewhere like France, people heard John talk yesterday about sort of how much of a force it was there. So the origins of revolutionary socialism in Vietnam, in fact, lie in the nationalist currents that developed in the similar period. Now, why? By the middle of the 1920s, and this might have come up in some of the other talks, the degeneration of the Russian Revolution domestically, following its defeat and the rise of Stalin, had led to a degeneration of Comintern and communist policy internationally. Yeah? This is the period, remember, for those of you that have been to a few of these sessions, when Stalin is pursuing his disastrous course of courting the nationalist Kuomintang in China as potential allies, right up until the moment that they massacre the Chinese communists and workers. So the politics of the Nationalist Annamite Party of Vietnam, founded in France in the 20s, with its denunciations of imperialism, offered a sense of direction for radical youth. I'll introduce two of them, sort of the two heroes of Vietnamese Trotskyism. Tha Thu Thao, who encounters them in France, and he quotes, he says, "The Comintern policy at the time was incapable of aiding the Vietnamese revolutionaries or going beyond Sun Yat-senism," one of the leaders of the Kuomintang. Right, it didn't offer them a sense of where to go from here. It didn't offer that attraction to them. So
Tatsu Tao is born in 1905 into a poor but educated family in Vietnam, becomes involved in nationalist action as he's a high school student, and leaves for Paris at the age of 22, where he helps found something called the Dang Tan Nham, the youth party, and later joins the Annamites. Here we meet another figure, Ho Hu Tuong, born in 1910, who was a poor peasant expelled from school for taking part in nationalist demonstrations again. So these people, even though they're very young, you know, have had a good sort of 10 years of experience in the struggle before they become revolutionary Marxists. And he again comes into contact with the nationalists in Paris amongst the Vietnamese community there. And I have to say, these are two of the great heroes of Vietnamese Trotskyism. So in Paris in the late 1920s, these two young nationalists and a number, a score of other Vietnamese students in the city, like I say, by no means bigger than this room, number of students, encounter the French section of Trotsky's left opposition. Now the left opposition appeals to them for two reasons. The left opposition combines intransigent revolutionary commitment to the opposition to colonialism, something that the Communist Party is lacking at the time because of its connections with the Comintern, with a revolutionary commitment to poor peasants and workers' struggles, right, to the class struggle, which is something the Annamites, the nationalists, lack with their, you know, desire to appeal to a Vietnamese bourgeoisie. And this drew these youth to the banner of revolutionary Marxism. Now, of course, surprise, surprise, the French authorities are none too pleased with this sort of contamination of radical ideas, and within months of encountering the left opposition, Tatu Tao, you know, is deported alongside 19 other Vietnamese left oppositionists from France, and for taking part in a demonstration. This is the sense of the persecution of so-called democratic France. So they take part in a demonstration, your visa's cancelled, you're off, you know, we're going to deport you. So after a period, again, that I don't have time to go into, of discussion and ideological clarification and a period of sort of a discussion circle amongst themselves, these young comrades fuse with a group already existing in Saigon, the Communist League of about 50 members, so again, much smaller than SA at the moment, and form their organisation. In 1931, they begin to publish an illegal paper that eventually becomes known as October, and Vietnamese Trotskyism is born. So I want to spend the rest of the talk focusing on three key events over the next 10 years. The united front of the Stalinists and Trotskyists in elections throughout the 1930s and the impact of the Popular Front government in France. The rising strike wave and struggle wave and the impact of the war that has on this. And finally, and I mean, really, really tragically when you think of the whole sort of course of post-war Vietnamese history and the millions of people that have to lose their lives, I want to look at the struggle that emerged after World War II and the way that it is defeated and smashed by Stalinism. But, I mean, first I have to sort of flag a question that I'm then going to proceed to ignore for the rest of the talk. Shortly after Trotskyism is established in Vietnam, its forces split over the question of legality and illegality and how they should operate. Tuong's supporters argue for an organisation that's completely illegal in its work, just goes underground, stays completely underground. This is the International Communist League in its paper, October. They take no part in the electoral fronts that I discuss later on. Tatu Tao's supporters, grouped around the paper La Lutte, the struggle, combine illegal and legal activity. They have an official presence and an underground presence. Now, I think the history of our movement shows conclusively that the model Tao advocated was the correct one. But that debate is not the main focus of my presentation. So throughout this, I'm going to talk about the two organisations interchangeably, depending on the struggles they're involved in. I think this is both because they both become serious forces, you know, like, for example, in the Saigon Arsenal, you know, the making of armaments factory, yeah? The October organisation has several hundred militants against the Communist Party's 100. But they both play roles in the story to come. But equally, I mean, there's other historical debates where we can go through legality and illegality. I don't think today's the... neither the time nor the place. So, the United Front. Let's look at the United Front. Bit of background here. Let's remember the international context informing the Vietnam to which Tao and Tuong return. 1929. What's happened in 1929, yeah? There's been the world crash, leading to massive recessions everywhere. The country's just been racked by a peasant uprising and strike levels are increasing. Yeah, there's serious military repression going on as well. So they're not moving back. It's not like Paris is the centre, Vietnam's this backward. Yeah, they're moving back to a country in turmoil. And what happens next in the coming years is, to my knowledge anyway, unique in 20th century history. The Trotskyists of La Lutte managed to convince the Stalinists of Ho Chi Minh's Indochinese Communist Party to enter into a united front and contest the Saigon municipality elections as a joint ticket, a pro-working class workers' movement ticket in these elections.
Now, of course, you know, the elections are a complete joke. Like, the French rig them, you know, disallow all the candidates who actually get allowed, all that kind of stuff. Like, the elections aren't the point here. You know, but the point is that they're an enormous propaganda opportunity. They're an enormous opportunity to reach, you know, large layers of Vietnamese workers, to sort of spread pro-working class ideas, to sort of forge an organisation, all these sorts of questions. Now, elsewhere in the world, opposition forces are too small, and the Stalinist third period lunacy of, you know, the social fascists and the main enemy, this sort of thing, that lunacy is too strong for their cause for unity to be heeded. And, you know, we remember this at our cost when we think of Germany, yeah, where there's these endless calls for Trotsky for united fronts against the imminent threat of fascism, which are unheeded and go down to the defeat that leads, you know, indirectly to Walter Benjamin's death. But there's another question that comes up as well. At this time, Ho Chi Minh's in Moscow, so the key leader of the Indochinese Communist Party is playing very little role in the strategic debates that are going on in the party at the time, right? So, you know, being headless, being without opposition, gives the Indochinese Communist Party the chance to do something sensible, as opposed to the kind of lines from leadership they'd have had if they had more cadre on the ground at the time. And I think this is significant because it explains why the United Front actually got off the ground, right? Why it's this unique event. But B, puts paid to the mythology of Ho as the leader, or, you know, the sort of great leader on the left, some still like to spin. So in March 1933, when it has its sort of kick-off, as the United Front, the joint ticket gains 17% of the vote in Saigon. Right, that's a massive start. Yeah, this gives an indication of how much turmoil there is in the working class. Half its candidates are manual workers. Right, this is 3 years. We've gone from an organisation of 20 students just deported from France now to present, you know, half its candidates in an election as being manual workers. Now, of course, like I said, the rulers find loopholes to disqualify the election results, but the point has been made, and La Lutte's influence spreads. You know, it's announced itself with a bang. They use every opportunity they're given through these elections to educate, agitate, and organise within the class. In May 1935, the Front wins 4 of the 6 seats reserved for the Vietnamese in the municipality, and Tha Thu Tao is one of those elected. On May Day in 1937, La Lutte uses its influence to organise a trade union federation of Vietnam. This draws in workers from at least 39 industries in Saigon and Cholon, including the government arsenal plant, tramways, rail, rice processing, sugar, and on the docks. By the start of the war, La Lutte has grown to around 3,000 members with the support of many more, you know, a wide base in the Vietnamese working class. Just before the war breaks out, and after the Front is broken, because, you know, eventually pressure begins to build on the Stalinists for reasons that I'll go into in a minute, La Lutte on its own, so competing against the Indochinese Communist Party on the one hand and the Nationalists on the other for these seats, wins 80% of the vote in the 1939 Cochin China Council vote, beating out both the Stalinists and the Nationalists. So we can say, you know, fairly clearly here in the South, that Trotskyism is the key ideology of the leading section of the working class in Vietnam, right? And, you know, that's something that has been completely written out of history, and I think not innocently. And, of course, behind these raw figures is a country in turmoil and a working class on the offensive. So, of course, the situation doesn't last. What breaks the United Front is the election of the Popular Front government in France in 1936. So what's the Popular Front? An alliance of reformists, the Socialist Party, the Radical Party, which is a bourgeois party in France, with the support of the Communist Party of France. It's a response to, and sort of paradoxically something that encourages, a working class revolt in France at the time. It's an attempt to contain it or to recognise it that has the sort of unintended effect of spinning it out of control in particular areas of France. The Popular Front government election raises enormous expectations in Vietnam, because these are some of these organisations had sort of ostensible commitments to independence or national autonomy. But of course, it doesn't deliver. In fact, the Popular Front suppresses local action committees that had sprung up in preparation for independence plans. So the Indochinese Communist Party and Ho Chi Minh are in a bind here. Where earlier Comintern policy had led them to denounce all nationalism, you know, and this is in an occupied country, right? All this nationalism is ridiculous. Now, the Popular Front demanded that they seek out alliances with local bourgeois nationalist forces and Buddhist parties. So the days of working with militant class fighters and revolutionaries had to be over, and it had to be over quick. So
So when the war breaks out, Ho Chi Minh had this to say. And just remember again, this is a war between France and Japan. Like, if you're in Vietnam, that doesn't mean it sort of have an immediate appeal to the nationalism that it might have in other countries in the working class. Ho Chi Minh says, for the time being, the party cannot put forth too high demands, national independence, parliament, etc. To do this is to enter into the Japanese fascist scheme. That's what they're all about, isn't it? Giving people parliaments. the French Communist Party's capitulation to imperialism, I think, is even more disgusting. And let's remember, the next quote I'm going to read is not from a Vietnamese. This is from a French socialist, someone living in the oppressive country. Maurice Thorez, in 1937, quotes, and this is the official position of the French Communist Party, if the decisive question if... Sure sign of rhetoric, right? If the decisive question at the moment is the victorious struggle against fascism, the interest of the colonial people lies in their union with the people of France and not in an attitude which could favour the efforts of fascism, right? How's that for outrageous? You know, and now the moment's arriving, get used to being part of an empire, suckers. Now, all this, of course, strengthens the position of the revolutionaries, right? Because the Trotskyists have been arguing from day one with the class struggle and with the struggle against the occupiers. We see them as the same thing. We're on the side of the tramway workers and we're on their side as Vietnamese. Their vote increases 80%, as I said earlier, right? Which is, you know, if you want to see a bigger increase, like, seriously, send it up. And Vietnam was in a state of enormous unrest until the outbreak of the war. Now, World War II breaks out, there's a very sort of physical reason why this unrest stops, which is known as massive, massive physical and military repression. As in France itself, part of Vietnam's ruled through the war by the Vichy French collaborationist government, yeah? So the French Quislings. They solve the problem of Vietnamese Trotskyism with mass repression. Tha Thu Thao, for example, is jailed immediately the war starts. He emerges seriously physically disabled after what we assume was years of torture and malnutrition. Goes on a number of hunger strikes, is force-fed poisoned food, is denied access, all the sort of things that we're seeing America's doing at the moment in Guantanamo Bay have a long and incredibly disturbing, upsetting history. Hundreds of others are jailed, many scores are shot. You know, militants, heroic militants we'll never know the name of, die, disappear. Both organisations become completely illegal. So this is a time of enormous suffering and loss for everyone. We'll skip the war, though, because I want to focus just on these three thematic issues. People can imagine it's a terrible time. Anyone knows anything about the Pacific War will know about the atrocities both the Australians and the United States and the Japanese carry out to all these peoples in all these areas. March 1945, the Japanese seize direct control of Vietnam. They're getting sick of this sort of puppet government. Shortly afterwards, they lose the war and retreat. Now, you'd think, great, you know, the imperialists have left. This is the end of the war. The defeat of the Japanese, however, has been something the Stalinists have been calling for years, right? But it poses them with an enormous problem. And why does it pose them a problem? Because of their loyalty to the USSR, and what's the USSR in alliance with at the moment, right? The great socialist fatherland, with the USA and the United Kingdom, you know, two of these imperialist countries in the world. And comrades might not know this, but Truman, you know, the war criminal butcher in charge of the American occupation of Japan and other areas here, issues a strategic order number one, a political order from the presidency, banning the Japanese army from surrendering to any force other than official allied forces. So this is the kind of rules of the game between gentlemen. It's just between the imperialists. You're leaving these countries, you're not allowed to surrender to anyone other than we say who you can surrender to. So all around Asia, the communist parties had to oppose independence struggles like Sukarno's in Indonesia that capitalised on the defeat of the hated occupiers to hopefully prevent the return of an older hated occupier. And they got rid of the Japanese. Do you really want the French to come back? Well, the communists have to say, no, 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 wait, 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 there's an order to this. So this leads to a seriously bizarre situation. Ho Chi Minh's I'm just going to call it the Communist Party, I'm getting tongue-tied. Ho Chi Minh's Communist Party, you know, through the Viet Minh coalition that they dominate, seize power in order to wait for the arrival of the Allied forces with whom to negotiate, right? So they take power, and they say, you know, they've got the guns, they've got the forces, they've got all the things here. We're going to wait here until we can find someone to negotiate who's in power here at the moment. Ho Chi Minh, right, the leader of the Communist Party, at the moment when they sort of seize this position of state power, immediately does what? First ticket to Paris to begin negotiations with the French government. How's normality going to resume? Leaves the country. So the Viet Minh take control of all of the north, but for 9 days after the Japanese surrender, Saigon is controlled by something called the National United Front. This is, we have to say, Vietnamese Trotskyism's finest hour and its most tragic. So what is the National United Front? This is where we see the beginnings of a workers' revolt in the South. Japan's retreat leads to an explosion of workers' self-activity, as many thousands of ordinary Vietnamese workers realise they have a chance to reshape the future of their country. Yeah, the hated occupiers are leaving, no one else is around, let's begin to build this independence. People are remembering the preparations for independence committees that have come out from the Popular Front government. Yes, the resumption of unfinished business. And of course, some of the rhetoric of the Viet Minh, you know, has been adding to this expectation. Yeah, what they've been saying for years now, kick out the Japanese fascists. The Japanese have been kicked out. Where do we go on from here? So from mid-August, the October group is involved in sending out over 150 people's committees to take power in local areas and coordinate the democratic management of public life and independence. Yeah, they're starting to actually run their own communities in preparation for how things will look from there on in. The National United Front contains a diverse grouping. You know, it includes nationalist forces, a number of Buddhist political parties, these sorts of things. But the real control, the real sort of political force that dominates, the force with the cadre, the force with the tradition, the force with the moral respect in the working class, lies in effect with Thaksin Shinawatra's La Lute group. So on the 21st of August, the National United Front organises a massive independence demonstration throughout Saigon. And I'll read an eyewitness account that is included in Samprani's bizarre but illuminating Vietnam Trotskyism. And it says, the Ho Hao and Cao Dai marched behind the monarchist flag with delegations of 100,000. The Trotskyists of October represented the other main pole of attraction in the march. Behind a large banner of the Fourth International came a series of placards and banners with the International Communist League's main slogans. As the banner of the Fourth International appeared, hundreds of thousands of workers who had never forgotten the revolutionary moments and movements of the 1930s flocked behind it. In a matter of a few hours, the contingent of the ICL grew to over 300,000, swamping the monarchists on these demonstrations. A real sense of the working class on the move, remembering these slogans, getting a taste of its own power. And this is sort of funny and indicates something as well. On September 1st, the Viet Minh called for a demonstration to welcome the Allied troops as liberators. Yeah, everyone come out, the Allies are coming, normality will return. Now, Vietnamese are sensible people. 400,000 turned up to the demonstration, but they turned up demanding independence. And they didn't only turn up demanding independence, large numbers of them turned up with sharpened bamboo spikes. So what we see here is not just demonstrations, I think it's very significant, comrades, though, demonstrations that are armed. This is the beginning of what we could see as being a situation where the struggle for state power is very, very sharp. So, no pun intended. And as well as there being sharpened bamboo spikes amongst the demonstration in general, the 18,000 strong La Lute contingent, 18,000 strong in the banner of Trotskyism at this demonstration, let's remember, are all armed, right? This is an armed contingent that's coming through with their politics coming through. Let's compare the slogans at the moment. La Lute arrives at the demonstration with the slogan, drive out the Japanese and French, right? Appealing to this sense here. The Communist Party comes out with the slogan, drive out the Japanese fascists. Has anyone noticed the problem with that slogan?
They're already gone.
And let's think about this, though. Let's think about this in terms of Stalinism's attempt to disarm the working class politically. They're already gone. Who's rapidly approaching, yeah? The French, the Allies, the United Kingdom, all the other occupiers. So yesterday's question, their militants on, today's question, they've got no sort of way forward for the movement. And in September, and this is truly disgusting, the Viet Minh greet the United Kingdom General Gracie as Vietnam's liberator. Yeah? And these are the Vietnamese people who have had to suffer massively in a war that's got nothing to do with any of what they've had to live through. So Ho Chi Minh is on his way back from Paris now because he realises that developments in the South seriously threaten the Stalinist position. Yeah? It's becoming untenable, the position of the Stalinists. Political leadership in the working class in the South lies with the Trotskyists. But the Stalinists have forces in their favour. Their strategy for the moment, remember we're talking about 1945 here, we're not talking about the 50s or the 60s, their strategy for the moment is in accord with and going in the same direction as the forces of the United Kingdom and French imperialism, right? So they don't have political leadership in the working class, but what they do have is the advantage of massive, massive military might behind them. And they have their bases and their control in the north, the less working class area of the country, and they rely on seizing the initiative. And also, and I don't want to go into this as well because it's disputed in the literature and I don't think it's significant for the talk, there's, you know, some suggesting that at least some in the Trotskyist camp underestimate the full ruthlessness of their opponents, yeah? Because they've got this tradition of the United Front earlier in the 1930s, are they necessarily prepared for the kind of fight that's about to hit them and hit them hard? So the day for the Allied invasion, or the resumption of normalcy, as Ho Chi Minh describes it, is fast approaching. Time is drawing the question to a crisis. Ho Chi Minh realises to resume normality, to regain sort of power for the Salinists within the struggle, he's going to have to harden up his own side. And these are quotes, I mean, I have them here. If anyone wants to doubt me, they can see them. These are quotes that have been systematically denied or been written out of history, like I said, by people like Tariq Ali or the Democratic Socialist Perspective for many decades now. Ho Chi Minh, 1945. There can be no alliance with the Trotskyite group. We must do everything possible to lay bare their faces as henchmen of the fascists and annihilate them politically. Ho Chi Minh again, 1945. All those who do not follow the line I have followed will be broken. Right? Letter after letter states this out. Now, I mean, you know, none of you have to be political geniuses. I think you can all read into that the message that's being made here. We must do everything possible to annihilate them politically. They must be broken. Right? What's the message being sent out to the cadres, the militias here? Let's read that. Now, it's also clear, though, as this moment arrives for the resumption of normality, that there are many, including, of course, the Trotskyists and the workers who support them here, prepared to take up arms against the Allies. And so on the 7th of September, the Viet Minh ordered the disarming of all non-governmental bodies, right? All these sharpened bamboo sticks that we put away. On the 14th of September, the Stalinists arrest the delegates moving to attend the meeting of the National United Front, right? They sort of... I don't want to call them workers' councils because they're not quite that, but they're sort of embryonic beginnings of council formations that are so inspiring. The delegates offer no resistance. So now we move on to the tragic part of the talk, the massacre. The Stalinist move has its desired effect. Encouraged by the passivity of the Viet Minh, the French move into Saigon in September and reoccupy all the key posts. Lê Văn Vung, who's a Trotskyist general secretary of the Saigon Council, is shot. Unexpectedly for the French, they encounter bitter resistance from the workers in Saigon, right? You know, someone forgot to let the workers know what the plan of the Communist Party was going to be. UK and French troops have to fight for Saigon against revolutionary workers. They're not welcomed as liberators, they re-invade. This is the third time Vietnam's been invaded in 7 years. The Viet Minh broker a truce, giving the imperialists breathing space and, crucially, entrance into the most rebellious suburbs, right? The Viet Minh use their leadership to let the Allies go into the suburbs where the workers are at their strongest and their most confident. Under the banner of the Fourth International, 210 workers fight and die resisting the French. But the Viet Minh keep the ammunition from the city and the French prevail. They simply run out of ammunition for their guns and are massacred in cold blood. What follows are months of massacres between September and February of 1946. The revolutionary moment has passed. French order begins to return. But Ho Chi Minh realises the political threat of French Trotskyism remains, right? The revolutionary moment's off the card, the French are there with their guns, but there's still a force here, you know, there's still organisation with cadre, with arguments, with respect in the working class. We know it has to happen, they're physically eliminated. Groups of Trotskyists from both parties escape Saigon, where they're unsafe, and put up resistance to both the French and the Viet Minh in the jungle and outside of the capital. The Go Vat militia, which is made up of tram workers from Saigon, hold an area of land until January 1946. So from September to January, they occupy this land when they're killed with their leader, Tran Dinh Minh, by Viet Minh. Hin Thai Tong from La Lut is arrested in May. Arrested at Mai Tho while running a meeting for a group of village delegates. In front of the village delegates, so a group of workers, you know, in the countryside is trying to educate the Viet Minh, disembowel him, show him his intestines as he's dying. In many areas, the Trotskyists are arrested en masse and never heard of again. How many are shot, we won't know. Again, whole section of militants of our movement will never even know the names of. All through this, the Viet Minh produced leaflets denouncing the Trotskyists as French imperialist agents. Those La Lut forces who try to reorganise armed resistance surrounded by the Viet Minh, their leaders, are all given military trials and shot. Finally, Tha Tu Tao, who's, like I said, severely disabled by 6 years of torture in prison, is captured, and he's got so much respect within the workers' movement that the Viet Minh realise they can't just shoot him summarily. They organise things they call people's courts to try him for crimes against the people. He's tried three times by three different people's courts, all of which acquit him unconditionally and say that he's a fine and upstanding citizen, you know. So, the Viet Minh simply shoot him in February 1946. Meanwhile, and this I think politically is, you know, on a moral par with all these massacres, having massacred his left opposition, Ho Chi Minh is now free to do deals with the right nationalists, the outflank his right. As a gesture of goodwill, he dissolves the Communist Party. It won't be seen again in Vietnam until 1951. So that ending, which I went through quite quickly, I think it's important that we realise here, it's overwhelming physical force is what destroys Vietnamese Trotskyism and is what knocks it out, but also recognising, you know, Stalinism wasn't some sort of current that, oh, we can have debates here, we can agree on where we go through. No, this is a threat. We're going to do everything possible to eliminate these people where we go through. So to conclude, what should we draw from this talk? For me, I think the story of Thao Te Tao and his followers is just incredibly moving. You know, when you hear about a group, like I was thinking, they're people very much like us in many ways, like younger people, people at university that discover these ideas when they're in Paris. What they can offer us, I think, because there's been a lot of sort of theoretical talks today, I think we need to remember the moral element to our struggle as well, that as a model of self-sacrifice and dedication, these comrades should be a model to us all, right? They gave their lives absolutely to the struggle, and we should remember that. We need also to remember them because the history has been obscured and hidden for too long. We need to know these stories because they're our stories. We have an obligation to make them our stories, so these deaths actually mean something. And these deaths that I ended with are also a warning. I went through them quite deliberately. You know? People sometimes ask why we place such an insistence on argument, on debate, on clarification. Well, I think Vietnam answers all that. Because Vietnamese revolutionary Marxism wasn't wholly eliminated in 1946, you see, when the 1960s radicalisation came, those who should have rallied to its persecuted and exiled remnants did no such thing. So fearful were they of looking at Ho Chi Minh's struggle with anything approaching clarity. Yeah? So fearful were they of entering into debates with young people who were coming into the movement. So when Chris Harman, who some of you might recognise the writings of in the International Socialists in Britain, so much as mentioned the massacre of the Vietnamese Trotskyists at a meeting in 1968, scores of so-called Trotskyists denounced him as a sectarian and walked out of the meeting, right? Merely for offending the North Vietnamese representatives there. Equally, you know, there were scores of these militants managed to escape to France in the 1950s, asked repeatedly for help and assistance from the Fourth International, told time and time again, there is no struggle here. You know, there is no struggle. Ho Chi Minh has empirically, revolved himself into a leading revolutionary figure. So when people get annoyed at us for picking arguments and being insistent in our arguments with sort of competing forces in Australia, these things matter. And I want to end with Trotsky's testament. He received a copy of La Lutte, and this is when he's at his darkest moment, you know, immediately having been kicked out. And he writes, "The voice of the revolutionary workers from Saigon is infinitely more important than all the pseudo-Marxist voices from the centre. The advanced workers of an oppressed country rally to a persecuted international. From the experiences of their own struggle, they have come to understand our programme and they will know how to champion it. Especially precious and important is the declaration that the advanced Saigon workers understand the meaning of the struggle of the left opposition during the years from 1925 to 1928. Only continuity of ideas creates a revolutionary tradition without which a political party sways like reeds in the wind." So here, this morning, this weekend, I think it's continuity of ideas, communist continuity of struggles and traditions, the fight for clarity, the fight for a programme. These are the tasks for militants today, and the lessons of Vietnam 60 years ago are part of our continuity, because championing their example should become part of our programme. The future in Australia, as much as Vietnam, belongs not to Ho Chi Minh and the dead weight of Stalinism, but to Thao Te Tao and the working class, the revolutionary Marxist tradition.